This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with crime fiction author Richard Price. Why don't I let Terry introduce it?
My guest Richard Price is one of my favorite writers. I look for his name, and so do a lot of other people. But he used a pseudonym for his new novel, The Whites. Well, kind of. The book is described as written by Richard Price, writing as Harry Brandt. Kind of confusing. Price will explain a little later. Price's name means something. He wrote Clockers, the novel about police detectives and drug dealers, which Price and Spike Lee adapted into a film. And he wrote for the great HBO series The Wire, which was also about police detectives and drug dealers. Price started his career with the novel The Wanderers, about street gangs in the Bronx where he grew up. He wrote the screenplay for Sea of Love, which starred Al Pacino as a homicide detective, and the screenplay for the movie adaptation of his novel Freedomland, which starred Samuel Jackson as a police detective. Richard Price returns to the world of police detectives in his new novel, The Whites, which is set in New York. In the New York Times book review, Michiko Kakutani praised Price for using detective work as a framework on which to build complex investigations into the human soul. Richard Price, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love your writing, so I'm going to ask you to start with a reading from your new novel.
Okay, this is from the first page of the first chapter. As Billy Graves drove down Second Avenue to work, the crowds worried him. 1:15 in the morning, and there were still far more people piling into the bars than leaving them, everyone coming and going, having to muscle their way through the swaying clumps of half-hammered smokers standing directly outside the entrances. He hated the no-smoking laws. They created nothing but problems. Late-night noise for the neighbors, elbow room enough for the bar-cramped beefers to finally start swinging, and a plague of off-duty limos and radio cabs all tapping their horns to hustle fares. It was the night of St. Patrick's, worst of the year for NYPD's night watch, the handful of detectives under Billy's command responsible for covering all of felony weight Manhattan from Washington Heights to Wall Street between 1 a.m. and 8 a.m., when there were no active squads in any of the local precincts. There were other worse nights, Halloween and New Year's Eve for two, but St. Patrick's was the ugliest, the violence the most spontaneous and low-tech. Stompings, blunt objects, fists, more stitches than surgeries, but some very malicious acting out. 1:15 in the a.m. Tonight, as always, the calls could come in at any time, but experience had taught him that the most fraught hours, especially on a drinking holiday, were between 3 a.m. when the bars and clubs started shutting down, everyone pouring out into the streets at once, and 5 a.m. when even the most hardcore animals were out of fuel and lurching off to oblivion. On the other hand, the city being the city, Billy never knew exactly when he'd see his pillow again. 8 a.m. could find him at a local precinct writing up bullets on an ag assault for the incoming day squad, while the actor was either still in the wind or snoring in a holding cell. It could find him hanging around the ER at Harlem Hospital or Beth Israel or St. Luke's Roosevelt, interviewing family and or witnesses while waiting for the victim to either go out of the picture or pull through. It could find him strolling around an outdoor crime scene, hands in pockets, toe searching through the detritus for shell casings. Or, if the Prince of Peace was afoot and Yonkers-bound traffic was light, he could actually be home in time to take his kids to school. There were gung-ho detectives out there, even on the lobster shift, but Billy was not one of them. Mainly, he hoped each night that most of Manhattan's nocturnal mayhem was not worthy of his squad's attention. Just petty nonsense that could be kicked back to patrol.
And that's Richard Price reading from his new novel, The Whites. Why did you want to return to writing about cops?
Because it just finally dawned on me. I always gravitate towards urban characters, street people, cops, the police and the policed, because I can laugh when I write. I just love the language. I don't know how to make lawyers laugh. I don't know how to make doctors funny. I just need to feel like these people are zingers, no matter how heavy or tragic or light the subject is. I have to feel like I can be dead on.
Why are cops funny in a way that, say, doctors aren't? They're both facing life and death situations, one in hospitals, one on the streets.
I'm not saying the job is funny. I'm not saying surgery is funny. I'm just saying I know, I understand cops. A lot of the people I grew up with became cops. I mean, it's sort of like myself talking. A lot of the people in the street are people I've known all my life. I'm just very comfortable with them. And I feel like humor comes not out of being comical, but out of being dead on accurate.
So the main character in your novel, The Whites, is a cop who was demoted after he shot what you describe as a giant armed with an already bloodied lead pipe. And the bullet passed through that guy and hit a 10-year-old Hispanic boy and nearly killed him. So this double shooting earned the cop both a citation for bravery and a civilian review board hearing and kind of a demotion, too. And this is why he's on night watch. So you're writing about this cop who totally accidentally shoots a 10-year-old boy. You're writing about, this is published at a time when there are so many people who are angry at police because of the deaths of young men like Michael Brown and Eric Garner. You're writing in this book about cops who have done good and cops who have done bad and cops who have done bad with the intention of doing good. And you're writing about everybody with a lot of empathy. And I'm wondering what it's like for you to have this novel about cops published at this time in our culture.
Well, I think this time in our culture has always been with us. Ferguson, Eric Garner, the kid in the pink houses in Brooklyn who was shot by that rookie cop in a stairwell. Things like this happen all the time. But this is the age of, you know, iPhones and cell snaps. But, you know, this has been through, God, can you imagine what it was like 75 years ago? I wasn't intending to write about racial elements of, you know, police versus the police, as I've done in the past. But now that Eric Garner has happened, that Ferguson has happened, I feel people ask me, well, is this what your book's about? And frankly, it isn't. If I were to write a book that was inspired by Eric Garner incident, I would not have used a pen name because that would be a book, like many of my others, that is talking to a larger ailment in the culture. What I intended to write was a tight urban thriller where what you see is what you get. And for me, it was a very different kind of book. Of course, it resonates now. I mean, because of the media blow up over the latest types of incidents, but they were not in my mind when I was writing this book.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Price, who has a new novel called The Whites. Why don't you explain what The Whites are? It's not a racial reference.
No, but given my history of writing, you know, I don't mind, you know, that it's a little confusing because anytime you write about police and justice, there's always a racial undertone. You know, even if it's not addressed directly. I mean, that's the world. The Whites, I've always seen detectives since 1986. There's always been one guy in every precinct who's been so haunted by a case that either knew who did it and couldn't prove it, or the guy walked, and the cop, it just gets inside this cop to the point when they retire, they're sneaking out all the legal boxes with, all the case files, all the transcripts, the interviews and everything. And they're going to continue working on it in their basement, you know, have a six-pack of beer and start making odd calls. Like, they're still cops. They can't let go of this thing. This thing can't let go of them. And it's different for every cop. What in a world, 20 years of mayhem, they each pick one case that got to them. And it's rarely the goriest case. It's rarely about a body count. It's about some element of this crime that spoke to them. Identification with the aggressor, identification with the victim. There but for the grace of God go I. the grieving family just feels like the family I wish I had and I never had. It's a kid. Anybody who touches a kid, it's an old person. The point is all these obsessed cops with their single case that's like malaria to them, they all reminded me of Ahab. So therefore, you know, they're looking for their whales. They're looking for their whites.
They're a great white whale.
One of the things I love about your writing is the great details in it and the things you observe. There's a character, I won't say much about who he is, but there's a character named Milton Ramos who's Puerto Rican and had been married to a Jewish woman. So he's visiting his Jewish aunt at an assisted living facility. And in her room, there's a bowl of silver and gold papier-mâché fruit, a plaster pair of life-sized praying hands, two ceramic menorahs, and a glazed and mounted ram's horn, as well as a framed print of a fiddler floating sideways above an off-balance ghetto. I can't tell you how many times I've seen those things, like in the 1960s.
Well, you know what?
What?
That's my mother's room in assisted living.
Really?
Yeah, and she's not religious, except, you know, she identifies and she's very emotional about being a Jew, but I don't think she's been in a synagogue since I was bar mitzvahed. But, you know, the whole point for me to go out is not, you know, the obvious things are the obvious things, but what breathes life, you know, into a scene or what my eyes register, what my heart registers are the tiny things. You know, I was vaguely describing a Chagall print. I can't tell you in my mother's place, which is non-denominational. I mean, even the Christians have Chagall paintings, you know, in their living rooms. The praying hands, all that stuff. I mean, some of this stuff is obviously made up, or not obviously, but it is, but you can't tell which is which. But it's always been about the details for me, always. I mean, the cops used to feel, I'd come out, and what I wrote about in Clockers was really small. I mean, it was a small, petty life, you know, petty crime, routine investigation. And a lot of the cops, after the book came out, said, I can't believe he wrote about this stuff. You know, we intercepted, you know, a 50-kilo cocaine shipment. Why didn't he write about that? Because that's the stuff you can read about that in the newspapers. What you can't read about is that this guy who had a fearsome reputation in the street, not only lived with his grandmother, but didn't have a chest of drawers in his room and kept all his clothes in a jumble, in a pile going up to his hips, you know, and that's how he chose how to dress. But on the street, he was a legend. At his home, he looked like somebody should buy him a chest of drawers.
There's more obesity in this novel than has been in previous novels of yours, which makes sense because there's more obesity in our culture than there used to be. Was that a conscious decision to put in, you know, several obese characters, and to also there's a former cop who's now a funeral director, and in one week he gets a 400 and a 500-pound corpse, and he realizes that if he adds on the weight of the coffin, that his front steps are going to collapse from the weight. So he actually has to send these bodies to another funeral home because they're just too darn heavy.
And the other funeral home was smart enough to put in reinforced steel on their steps because they know the situation. You know, I live in Harlem, and there's an obesity problem around where I live now that is hard not to see. Like I described in the book, you'll see a Roy Rogers, a Dunkin' Donuts, and a big woman's moo-moo shop, and then a funeral home, you know. And it's like a de-evolution cartoon. It was right in front of my eyes. I've been living there for close to 7 years now. And it was, depends where. You're not going to see that kind of obesity if I was writing about, you know, Gramercy Park or Tribeca, you know. But there are other parts of the city and, hell, the country. I mean, like I said, you know, there are fat people in Nebraska, too. You know, and it's just, it's a national plague, but I wasn't thinking about it any more than just making observations through the eyes of a funeral director.
This new book, The Whites, is the first one you've written under a pen name, the pen name of Harry Brandt. How unethnic
that is correct,
does that
sir.
Sound?
I'm trying to pass.
Why a pen name for this one?
Well, first of all, I just want to say I picked the name Brandt in honor of my former agent, Carl Brandt, who had represented me from the time I was 22 till the time I was 40, and who had died the year before. And I was just giving him a little shout-out by choosing his name. The reason why I picked the pen name was because what I intended to do in this book was slicker, tighter, faster, more the surface of what's happening, more propelled by the mystery at its core. And I didn't have any social resonance my earlier books, I was always inspired by a crime that spoke to a larger issue in the culture, the Susan Smith kidnappings, the gentrification of the Lower East Side, the impact of crack on a community, which was Clockers. This time, I just wanted to write about people. I wanted to focus on the characters, you know, not the social impact of the story. And I thought it was just going to be a tighter, faster, more genre-oriented book. And it was going to be different from my other books, and I wanted to signal that.
Why couldn't you say, I'm writing a different book than my other books? Why did you need a pen name to signal that?
Well, there was a number of things. In a contractual gentleman's agreement way, that I owe a book to Farrah Straus Giroux, and they were basically allowing me to write a book for Hult, even though I owed one to them. And at first, I really thought it was going to be a very different book from any of my other books. And there was also the possibility that there would be a franchise. You know, the model obviously is Banville Benjamin Black. But I wasn't thinking. I haven't even read any of Benjamin Black's books.
He's the pen name of James Banville.
John Banville.
John Banville. And John Banville writes very literary novels. Under the pen name, he writes genre fiction.
Right. And for him, it seemed effortless. His you know, from the small scenes that I've read in there, he just flows into that character. And it's a much different persona than John Banville writing The Sea. And I was under the illusion that I could do the same thing. I could drop a lot of the stuff that was big to me, you know, just to write about plot and character, write fast, write slick, make it propelled by mystery. But once I started writing, I couldn't write any other way than the way I always write, and it became another 4-year struggle to create a book. It's supposed to be 4 to 6 months, my agent said to me, and I said, hey, great, I can do that. Well, guess what? I can't. And once I realized deeper into the process that this is just going to be another Richard Price book, I hate people who refer to themselves by their names, like Kanye don't play, says Kanye. And, you know, I just all of a sudden I realized it's just another damn book by me. But at that time, it was too late to withdraw the pen name. And so I'm living with it. But if I had to do it all over again, if I had a crystal ball 4 years ago, I would have had it under my own name.
There are several characters. You know, like the police and the police precinct are characters in your novel, but hospitals are characters too. One of, you know, the main character, the main detective's wife is a nurse. You describe her as a triage nurse in the St. Anne's Knife and Gun Club ER. And I'm wondering if you've had to spend a lot of time in hospitals for friends, family, for parents.
Well, I had an infantile hernia when I was 3, and I was born in a hospital, but not an awful lot. The thing is, if you're going to be a cop that's responding to crime scenes, you're going to wind up in a hospital about 3 or 4 times a night, talking to victims, talking to the people that brought the victim in, talking to the doctors, talking to the witnesses. Every time I went out with Night Watch, I saw some of the finer and some of the grimier ERs in Manhattan. It's just the nature of the job, and to not acknowledge that would be to leaving out a huge chunk of what a Night Watch cop's job is. The other thing is that in my experience, I'm not a sociologist, but I would say so many cops are married to nurses, and it's just the way it is. It's, you know, mom's a nurse, dad's a cop, or mom and dad are cops. Rarely are mom and dad, you know, doctor nurses. And you know what? You talk about meeting cute. You know, that's where they're going to meet their spouses, you know, following up a homicide, following up an aggravated assault, you know, and you go to the same hospital maybe three times a week for a couple of months. You get to know these people and they get to know you pretty well. And it's kind of like this medical courtship around mayhem.
The father in your novel, the father of the main police detective, has dementia and is living with the detective. And if you don't mind my asking, did you go through that with your parents at all?
No, not at all. My mother's going to be 90 in April, and she's sharp as a tack.
Good.
My father died when he was 84. He was playing racquetball that day and poker that night, and he just had a cerebral hemorrhage. And, you know, it's like somebody turned out the light. They didn't suffer the indignities of deterioration. I think I have a little bit.
What do you mean by that?
I don't know. It started when I was 13. I think it was called sexual awareness. but other than, you know, I'm fine. No, I mean, dementia is not something that runs in my family. Thank God.
How are your parents' lives changed by your success?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, the irony is that when you come from a working class family, such as I did in the Bronx, where my father was a cab driver and a small store window dresser. My mother was a housewife. She had a tiny hosiery store. Later on, she was a bank teller. And these are people that were born in the 20s, and they grew up haunted by the Depression. And they never had children that surpassed them and actually went to college and had had some real options out in the world. So they couldn't understand the fact that I wanted to be a writer because there's no job coming. You know, there's no context and there's no security to validate your kid wanting to be something in the arts when you grew up struggling. So they were totally upset that I didn't take the job at Blue Cross Management Trainee Program, which was offered to me when I graduated. Because I wanted to go to Columbia and study just fiction workshops for 2 years. And it was very hard for them to accept. And when I had success after that, they were poleaxed. They weren't poleaxed because they didn't have confidence in me, but they were poleaxed that something like this can work. And they, like myself, they were kind of knocked over by my success. You know, every time I saw my father up until his 80s, he would look at me and just say, "We didn't know." You know, and that plaintive kind of shrugging your shoulders, like, "What do you want? We didn't know. We did our best." I think it wasn't like they didn't have confidence in me. They didn't have confidence in the situation. And they were very protective and anxious that I wouldn't wind up being a ditch digger.
The last time you were on Fresh Air, which was about 5 years ago, after the publication of your novel, Lush Life, which was set on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, you mentioned that your grandfather was locked up a number of times on the Lower East Side of Manhattan for violent crimes. And somehow I think I've neglected to ask you the follow-up question, what crimes? So I'm going to ask you today, what crimes?
Well, first of all, I might have been a little romantic and mythical about my grandfather. You know, he wasn't a killer. He was a poor kid in a ghetto neighborhood of the Lower East Side. And all the poor kids, just like today, they idolized the gangsters. And he idolized the gangsters in his environment. And he started running with them. And he was a gopher for them. And one time he was collared he had to hide a gun after a murder because he was this 14-year-old gee whiz kid looking up to his gods who were 17 in the pool hall. And he said, "Hey, Artie, do me a favor. Keep this shoebox in your closet." And he said, "Don't open it," which if that was me, the first thing I'd do is open it. But anyways, he just came home from peddling shoelaces on the street, he told me that one day, and his tenement apartment was flooded with cops, and they had a murder weapon, and he had it. So he went away for that when he was in his and he's also a guy who thought with his hands. You know, he was kind of like an emotional, he was a violent mama's boy in a way, where he's very sentimental, and he just liked to fight, you know, and he liked an opportunity to prove himself, and it got him into some bad situations. And there was a time during the Depression, he was a poultry truck driver coming out of the Hunts Point Terminal delivering chickens to Chinese restaurants, and he was fired by his boss because he took two chicks home from my mother, who was probably six at the time. And the boss fired him, and he went down to this poultry wholesaling place, which used to be on 14th Street, you know, to beg for his boss to, you know, take him back. And the boss not only didn't take him back, but he said, "You're blackballed out of this industry. You'll never work again." And my grandfather lost it and beat the guy to an inch of his death. He just broke all his ribs. He was just going insane, you know, and he was spirited out of there, you know, by other guys that he knew on the job. But he was arrested in his home, and he went to a cop in the Bronx, South Bronx, Southeast Bronx. It was Vise Avenue for those who lived there. And anyways, and he begged the cop if he could help him out. And the cop said to him, "Well, here's what's going to happen. You're going to go in front of a judge. The judge is going to throw the book at you. He's going to scream and curse you out, you know, for the subhuman that you are. You're going to be steered towards a door, a side door, and you're going to go out in cuffs through that side door." And that's what's going to happen. My grandfather went there. The guy he beat up was there. He was wearing an entire body cast, like, you know, something out of a Mel Brooks movie with just a middle finger exposed. And the judge, you know, tore him a new one, sentenced him. He went out that door in cuffs. The minute he was out the door, he realized he was in an alley. And 1 second later, this cop who was behind him booted him in the behind so hard that he went off the ground both feet. And the cop, after that, uncuffed him and said, "If you ever make me do this for you again, I'm going to say to hell with you."
So you've been quoted as saying that what you really want to do most, that you write for TV, you do movies, but what you really want to do is write novels. And I'm thinking, much as I love your novels, why would you be so insistent on writing novels in an age when fewer and fewer people, sadly, read them?
Well, it's all that crap. The novel is dead. You know, cable took over, you know, a novel's purpose. In the world. It's just a bunch of nonsense. You know, the novel will outlive us all. We'll be at our funeral. And of all the art forms for a storyteller, everyone that pays better, screenplays, TV, there's a committee over your head that determines what you're supposed to do. You are basically writing for them to feel like, yeah, this is marketable. We can get a maximum audience for this. When I'm writing my books, nobody tells me anything. You know, if I trust my editor and I have a rapport with my editor, I listen. And with my current editor, John Sterling, I listened very hard. He was the editor for me for Clockers and Freedomland. But I'm free. I'm free to write what I want. I don't have to worry about whether people in Montana, you know, are going to tune into my novel. You know, it's just me writing about what I know the best way I can, answering to no one.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded earlier this week with David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker magazine, which is celebrating its 90th anniversary. Remnick joined The New Yorker as a staff writer in 1992 and became the magazine's editor in 1998. He's guided The New Yorker through many crises, including 9/11 and the war in Iraq, as well as many crises in the changing world of media that have led to shrinking newspaper circulation and the demise of several magazines. The New Yorker still does what it's famous for: elegantly written long-form investigative pieces and profiles, reviews, cartoons, humor pieces, fiction, and listings. And under Remnick's tenure, the magazine has brought that and more into the digital sphere. Remnick started his career at the Washington Post, where he became a Moscow correspondent. His book, Lenin's Tomb, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire, won a Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction.
David Remnick, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the 90th anniversary. Of all the magazines in America, I think The New Yorker is probably the one with the most traditions that are cherished by readers. The cover illustrations, the cartoons, talk of the town, the long profiles and investigative pieces, its listings, its fiction, its humor pieces, movie theater music, reviews. Readers want those traditions left intact. But on the other hand, I bet that unless you really updated things in some ways, that readers wouldn't really read it. You know what I mean? I think there's sometimes this disconnect with what people insist that they want and what they'll actually read in changing times.
I think that's absolutely right. Look, I joined The New Yorker as a writer in 1992 after coming home from Moscow as a newspaper reporter. And I was there and watched and was part of as Tina Brown introduced into the magazine Heaven for Fend, photographs. This was a revolution on the par of the storming of the Bastille in magazine terms. And she introduced photographs by having one photographer, Richard Avedon, whose both his library and the things that he added to it were immensely beautiful and added to The New Yorker. But there were people that resisted it because it hadn't been there before. People have a conservative instinct sometimes, but it doesn't last long if the new thing is good, if the new thing works.
One of the things you've done is bring The New Yorker into the digital age. And one of the things about digital media is that you can actually measure how many people are reading each article, each page of each article. Is that a mixed blessing or is that just, you know, an out-and-out good thing for you? The reason why I ask is, it's sometimes depressing to see what gets the most hits or what gets the most clicks because it's sometimes the thing with the most recipes. Not that there's anything wrong with recipes, but, you know, you'll do like a really important piece about something and that doesn't get nearly amount of attention as the recipes are going to get. And, you know, how much do you let that guide you in terms of what you want, you know, a publication or a radio or a TV show to be? So
Well, I should say first that sometimes what people are clicking on is enormously gratifying. Very, very often our readers are reading the absolute thing you're dying for them to read. So today, people are reading, what are they reading most of all in the new issue? It's a 17,000-word profile of Johnny Ive, the chief designer at Apple. But you're absolutely right. Sometimes, you know, let's take a piece on a certain kind of foreign affairs piece that's difficult, maybe even depressing to some readers. The key is, if you're editor, you have to insist upon that being there. I know in my heart that when The New Yorker is delivered, that the readers first will go to the cartoons. And they're not necessarily, after an exhausting day of work, the kids being aggravating or whatever it is that's causing you to be, you know, distressed or exhausted at the end of the day, probably your first instinct is not going to be, let's read the 7,000-word piece from Libya by John Lee Anderson that, you know, John Lee only reported at danger to his life and one of the rare reporters to get in there. But let's say the weekend comes around and you're in a better mood and you're a little bit more forgiving and you're curious about the world. Then you're going to read that piece, or maybe a week from now or 2 weeks from now, because the piece is written in a way that's not disposable. It's a very, very different animal.
So editing The New Yorker is a wonderful job, a real privilege that I'm sure comes with an enormous number of real headaches, including legal headaches. So let's look at a couple of legal headaches that you've handled over the years. Scientology. Lawrence Wright wrote a lengthy investigative piece about Scientology. The Scientology organization is famous for being litigious. And so you probably expected that you would be challenged and possibly sued, possibly for a lot of money. So just in saying yes to this piece, you opened the door to a lot of legal headaches. Knowing that, why did you say yes? Like, and I'm not saying you should have said no, but you know, I'm sure that you have to take that into account. Like, what are you exposing the magazine to? What are you exposing yourself to when you take on something like that?
I'm sorry, you have to take those things on all the time, not just with Scientology. You should be doing it all the time. Otherwise, you're not doing your job. I mean, journalism, some huge percentage of it should be devoted to putting pressure on power, on nonsense, on chicanery of all kinds. And if that's going to invite a lawsuit, well, you know, bring it on. The burden on us is to be accurate and fair. And so with Scientology, yes, you know, it wasn't lost on me that they had sued any number of people and organizations in the past. But it seemed that their strategy had changed by the time it got to us. The strategy had gone from suing after publication, where they inevitably lost, and I think they're not fools, they saw that they were losing, to trying to put as much pressure on the editorial process ahead of time to make the story, in their terms, less tough or less damaging.
So what kind of pressure did they put on you?
Well, when we sent them, I believe it was 900 checking questions, they, let's put it mildly, were alarmed. And they asked for a meeting, and they came to New York from California, and we had a meeting that lasted 8 hours, I believe. And their team, which I think they brought 7, 8 people, I forgot what it was, and they brought, I don't know how many dozens of binders of material they brought. Now, this all turned into, I should admit, repertorial gold for Larry Wright. It was only more information, and it heightened the level of accuracy, but it also deepened the level of information. And the piece came out. It ran 25,000 words in an anniversary issue, I believe, 5 years ago. People read it like crazy online, in print, and there was no lawsuit.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Remnick, who's been the editor of The New Yorker since 1998. He first joined the magazine in 92 as a staff writer. The magazine is celebrating its 90th anniversary this week with a special edition. So you are the fifth editor of The New Yorker, the fifth in 90 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fair to say that the most famous, the most legendary of the editors is William Shawn, who was famous not only for what he did with the magazine, but he was a famous eccentric who had several phobias. Mm-hmm. I think he was afraid to ride elevators. I don't think he traveled. He had a secret life that was revealed after he left the magazine. He'd had an almost second wife, Lillian Ross, one of the longtime writers for The New Yorker. And, of course, he was also very obsessive about the magazine, you know, to his credit as an editor.
You have to be.
Yeah. But anyways, because he's such, like, the legendary editor and he was such an eccentric, do you ever feel like, well, to measure up, you need to have a secret life, some phobias, be a little bit more eccentric?
Oh, my God. No, look, we all have something because we're all people. And I think what happens is that people are they have a cartoon. And Harold Ross, who was no less famous in his time than William Shawn in his time, you know, the cartoon of him was that he was a kind of Western rube and that he didn't know whether Moby Dick was the man or the whale. But in fact, he was a kind of brilliant, original, extremely smart, and invented the whole damn thing. You know, William Shawn's cartoon is that he, you know, wore 16 sweaters in the summertime and that he had a tiny, whispery voice. But in fact, as Harold Brodkey once said, he was a combination St. Francis of Assisi and Napoleon. You need to have a real core of determination and obsession and attention to do the job. But all these people have had cartoons of themselves in reality. Bob Gottlieb, who followed Shawn, the cartoon of him was that he was, you know, kind of a eccentric dance, you know, a balletomane. But it was ridiculous. I mean, the core of him was as a brilliant reader, particularly of fiction, a fantastic and pivotal figure in American post-war fiction as an editor. And the cartoon of Tina was, you know, party-going and interested in only what was hot, hot, hot. And in fact, she modernized the magazine in a very short period of time in a way that was extremely helpful to me when I came along.
So what's your cartoon?
Well, the cartoon of me is that somehow I write 10,000 word pieces, you know, while standing on 1 foot in 5 minutes. It's ridiculous.
Now, I read that when you were young, a kid, you wrote your own newspaper at home. You wrote all the articles. You had a series of pen names that you used. Tell us a little bit about that newspaper.
Well, I grew up in a pretty ordinary suburban New Jersey town, middle class, and went to a big public high school. And very few people were interested in the idea of a high school newspaper. And I regret to say that it was called the Smoke Signal, the newspaper, because we were the Pasquette Valley Indians. And it's completely wrong, and I apologize for it, and I'm afraid it's still called that. And certainly the team, I don't know about the newspaper. And so I did it pretty much by myself, and sometimes.
So this was not just a publication in your home. This was actually the school newspaper.
No, it was the school newspaper, which didn't have a hell of a lot of interest. I don't know why. And so I did it on a what used to be called a bridge table, in my parents' house. It wasn't very good. And, you know, you used scissors and paste and all kinds of primitive non-technology to do it. And I think I even had a little job writing stupid articles for one of those community shoppers, you know, those giveaway papers that used to exist, mm-hmm. about, you know, school board meetings and things like that. I just thought this was the most romantic thing ever. I was a childhood insomniac, and I would stay up all night and listen to talk radio. There was sadly no Terry Gross in those days, but there was Long John Nebel, and there was Barry Gray and the kind of left-wing Alex Bennett, and I'd listen to this stuff, and they would talk to these newspaper reporters and magazine writers, and they would talk for hours, and it was absolutely fascinating. They went out into the world, and they saw it firsthand. And this seems so vivid compared to my unbelievably boring suburban upbringing I knew I couldn't be a novelist. At a certain point, quite frankly, my mother had multiple sclerosis since I was six. And a bit later on, my father also got ill. And I somehow knew, certainly by college, that I would need to make a living. I couldn't just sort of declare myself a novelist. And I knew that somehow I'd have an abnormal amount of responsibility. And I just thought journalists sounded so great. And I grew up in this time of journalism was becoming something completely new with Hunter Thompson and Gay Talese and Sarah Davidson and James Baldwin and all these things. It just seemed that's all I ever wanted to do.
One of the serious challenges you faced as a father is that your youngest child, your youngest of three,
yes,
who's 15 now, has autism. Is it severe on the scale?
Yes, it's quite severe. I have two sons who are in their 20s and who are doing great, Alex and Noah. One's a photographer for the New York Star Ledger. And the other is finishing Yale and, you know, absolutely healthy and glorious in you know, just wonderful kids. And Natasha is wonderful in her way, too. But, you know, she has has very serious autism. And it's a huge challenge for my wife and I and for my sons and for and above all for her.
I know you don't have a lot of time to socialize, I'm guessing that, between your family and the magazine, which both are so demanding in their own ways. But, you know, when you're an editor, I would imagine it's sometimes hard to socialize because with The New Yorker, probably every writer would like to be in The New Yorker. And probably everybody who is especially accomplished at what they do would like to be profiled in The New Yorker. Or they have an aunt, mother, child, grandparent, parent who should be a writer or who should be profiled in The New Yorker. Or they have a suggestion for an article that you really should assign a reporter. Or they're going to tell you about the best or the worst thing that you've recently published. And that might not be the way you really want to spend your spare time.
You know what? I am open to it. And the other night I was up at Columbia and did a conversation with Victor Navasky, who's ran The Nation for so many years and is now at the Columbia School of Journalism. And I cut off the discussion by saying, before you ask, here's my email address. And if you want to send me ideas or you want to send me manuscripts, bring it on. Bring it on. The odds are tough. I remember when I was in my 20s, I sent William Shawn a query letter. And I got an answer. And I never forgot getting an answer.
What was the answer?
And the answer was no. But I never forgot the time that was taken to write a cogent, short note about why not. And I also remember when I submitted my first piece to The New Yorker, which was happily accepted by Gottlieb, by Bob Gottlieb, he answered that day, that night. And I'll never forget that. And I know in my heart that I'm falling short all the time in a million different ways. But I try to answer emails, letters, phone calls, because I know not only is it the right human thing to do, I think, but also once in a blue moon, it's going to pay off. Once in a blue moon, you are going to get a short story, a suggestion, an idea that's going to find its way into The New Yorker and be something or someone brilliant. And that's part of the job, and it's a delightful one.
David Remnick is editor of The New Yorker magazine, which is celebrating its 90th anniversary. You'll find a longer version of Terry's conversation with Remnick online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.